Call the Veterans Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Division to order. We do not have a quorum yet, but we will stand for the pledge first.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, and we do have a quorum now, I believe. So Representative Becker Finn, would you approve the minutes from February 12th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any errors or omissions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries. All right, first on the agenda is a presentation from the Department of Minnesota Veterans of Foreign Wars. I have Tom Hansen, Patrick Bulmer, and Tommy Johnson. So I don't know if you're coming up in that order or if we all come up at the same time, but.
Where are we going here?
Just right here, and then when you want it to go, just hit play and it should be good to go. I hope.
Good afternoon.
Please proceed, gentlemen, and identify yourselves for the record.
My name is Tom Hansen. I am the state commander for the Minnesota VFW. I have with me Patrick Bulmer, our state adjutant, and Tommy Johnson, our legislative chairman and homeless veteran chairman. We appear today to give some insight on our organization and what it is that the VFW does in the state of Minnesota. And if I'm not mistaken, everybody has been given some documentation from the organization relative to the history of the VFW. I'm not real certain what exactly everybody was given, but I'm presuming that the organization sent some handouts over relative to our organization. For those of you that did not get that or were unable to review that, the Veterans of Foreign Wars is the oldest combat veterans organization in the world, essentially, at least in the United States that we're aware of. We were organized in 1899 by some Spanish-American war veterans that came home with illnesses and other situations that kept them from prospering in society, and as a result did what they could to come forward and get a band of brothers, so to speak, to appear in front of Congress and establish what we now know as a number of GI entitlements. Obviously, our organization played a major role in establishing a number of the GI entitlements, most notably the GI Bill of Education. And to this day, we have a rather large legislative lobby in the Washington area that has a full-time position of lobbying for veterans' entitlements. So our organization is integrally involved in the legislative process. We in Minnesota, obviously, as well, have an interest in legislation that is available, or we would like to have available to the veterans of Minnesota. And as a consequence, back in the 40s, our organization, or the Department of Minnesota, established a service office that currently does business at Fort Snelling, along with a number of the other service organizations. Our current budget to run our service office is roughly $315,000. That's an annual budget for five employees. And the latest information that I received from our department service officer indicates that the benefits generated through that office is $462 million. Now, that's money that our organization brings back into the state of Minnesota as a result of our efforts at Fort Snelling. So if we're spending $315,000 and generating $462 million for the taxpayers of Minnesota, we're pretty proud of that aspect of our veteran service arm. And we figure the VFW only represents 22% of the veterans of Minnesota. The Department of Veterans Affairs from Minnesota obviously handles the lion's share of claims, and as does the disabled American veterans. So essentially, there's been more than one hearing in front of a committee similar to this that the question was asked, why do all the service organizations present testimony in front of a committee asking for money from the state legislature when you're all doing the same thing? Well, the reality of that is that we have a number of veterans that choose the Veterans of Foreign Wars as their representative. We have veterans that choose the American Legion, the DAV, any one of a number of different service organizations to present their claim on their behalf in front of the VA. Those that designate the VFW obviously are the individuals that we're obligated to represent. The unique part about the VFW is that our organization is the only service organization in the state of Minnesota that funds their claims office entirely by ourselves. The other service organizations either are run by a national office or are funded or have their claims operation run through the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. So essentially that $315,000 that we procure to run our service office, half of that comes from the state legislature, and I want to thank you all for that generous obligation that you have. And if I'm not mistaken, the Commander's Task Force will be coming forward with a bill that would ask that dollar amount be increased. By the way, we're looking for an author of that bill if anybody's interested. So the fact remains that the bang for the buck really is quite remarkable. If we spend $315,000 and generate $462 million for the taxpayers of this state, obviously I don't need to tell you any more about that. Now, that's just the veteran service aspect of our organization. Obviously, we have a number of community service programs and a number of other aspects of our organization that are twofold, essentially, one for those in the community and those in our local posts that do a lot of work. And I'm sure that most of the members of the committee and the audience here is relatively aware of what the VFW does in their community. And it's no secret they've got a long history of doing well, presenting flags and trying to foster other patriotic aspects for the community. We do have a scholarship program for high school students as well. And I did bring along a tape of the this year's winner of the VFW's Voice of Democracy program that I'd like to run for you that will demonstrate how the young people of this state are doing well in carrying on the traditions of Americanism and patriotism. And this is our state winner the second place winner. I guess the state winning tape has already gone forward to Washington and will represent the state of Minnesota at our Washington conference the first week in March. So without anything any further ado, okay.
Mr. Johnson, I'm not a technical guy, but we got smart people here that can figure it out. So.
Well, obviously, I'm not either. But I think he said hit play, and I just don't know where to hit play.
Theodore Roosevelt once stated, "The ultimate rulers of our democracy are not a president and senators and congressmen and government officials, but the voters of this country." Sitting in a high school history class, time inches past for Franklin D. Roosevelt once stated, "The ultimate rulers of our democracy are not a president and senators and congressmen and government officials, but the voters of this country." Sitting in a high school history class, time inches past for some at a painfully sluggish pace. Many young Americans, just months away from their 18th birthdays, meet the lesson on the inner workings of our government with apathy. It is not uncommon for young Americans to lack enthusiasm for these topics, and it is unsurprising that millennials have the lowest voter turnout percentage of all age groups, according to a 2018 article published by the Pew Research Center. This is an issue of concern for every American citizen, for every vote is essential to keep the gears turning in this great democracy. Voting is not only an American citizen's right, but their responsibility. By exercising their right to vote, American citizens fulfill their duty to make positive change occur around them and help safeguard the American dream. Entering a polling booth is a sacred duty shared by Americans across the country. With a simple pen stroke, the course of history is rewritten. Franklin D. Roosevelt once stated, "The ultimate rulers of our democracy are not a president and senators and congressmen and government officials, but the voters of this country." Sitting in a high school history class, time inches past for some at a painfully sluggish pace. Many young Americans, just months away from their 18th birthdays, meet the lesson on the inner workings of our government with apathy. It is not uncommon for young Americans to lack enthusiasm for these topics, and it is unsurprising that millennials have the lowest voter turnout percentage of all age groups, according to a 2018 article published by the Pew Research Center. This is an issue of concern for every American citizen, for every vote is essential to keep the gears turning in this great democracy. Voting is not only an American citizen's right, but their responsibility. By exercising their right to vote, American citizens fulfill their duty to make positive change occur around them and help safeguard the American dream. Entering a polling booth is a sacred duty shared by Americans across the country. With a simple pen stroke, the course of history is rewritten. The people have their final say. As Americans cast their votes, they leave behind the echoes of their voices on the pages of history books. This historic tradition must be upheld so that the power remains in the hands of the people. It is necessary for all Americans to fulfill their birthright by voting, as it is a right given to them for the purpose of preserving this democracy. Many may feel as though they are powerless amongst the onslaught of opposing voices. However, at the end of an election, every American's ballot holds the same power. The power to lift up their heroes and to tear down their oppressors. This power is relinquished if Americans remain apathetic and do not vote. Society must remind them that this government is built by the people. When they vote, they affect not only their own lives, but the lives of those around them. They vote on behalf of their family, friends, and neighbors. They vote for those who depend on compassionate and thoughtful leaders. They vote for those who have sacrificed their lives to allow this country to thrive. Americans do not vote because they are powerful. Americans are powerful because they vote. For American citizens, voting is the perfect embodiment of the American dream. The promise of freedom, opportunity, and democracy has inspired millions to travel from great distances and endure immense hardship to pursue this dream. Generations of immigrants and soldiers have built and defended this country so that all Americans can achieve their goals. Men and women across the United States are able to speak their mind and decide how their lives are lived. Their voices help keep the promise of freedom alive. With every ballot counted, Americans protect and promote the American dream. Around the United States, politicians are preparing daily for upcoming elections. Most Americans think that it is truly right that only politicians think about these elections and not everyday citizens. This is incorrect. Elections are not about politics, parties, or bureaucrats. Elections are about people. People from across this vast country coming together on Election Day for one unified purpose. For all upcoming elections, Americans of all ages and backgrounds must pledge to stand up and vote, not just for themselves, but for their country. Every voice counts. Every vote counts. And those votes that are cast today create the United States of tomorrow.
That was the second place state winner by a young 11th grade student named Jessa Mueller from Melrose High School. Obviously, the state winner is on the way to Washington for our Washington conference. So, they're vying for a $30,000 a year scholarship. Each state winner has a guarantee of $1,500 and are all, like I say, vying for a $30,000 scholarship. The state winners, every post essentially runs this program, and in the state of Minnesota, we have winnings or scholarship awards to these students that is in excess of $50,000. So it's incredible that we see in our youth the fact that we still have patriotism and Americanism going on, and we owe that obviously to their parents and their teachers. So I've got a couple of gentlemen with me here that have spent a few years in the organization as well. Patrick, is there something you'd like to add that I've neglected? Thank you for obviously listening to what I had to say.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen.
Well, my name is Patrick Bomer, and I am the state adjutant this year for the VFW. Tommy tells me what to do, and I tell him where to go. Not really, but it's just that I answer all the correspondence that comes through the office, and when people call up and need help with the bylaws, make sure that they're doing things right, that's part of my job.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Mr. Johnson.
I'm Tommy Johnson. I'm the legislative officer and the homeless veteran officer for the Department of Minnesota Veterans Foreign Wars. And what I do more than anything else is listen to what our members want. We are a grassroots organization. Ideas and wants and needs come out of the post level, go to the district, and come up to department level, and that's where I come in. We recently had our midwinter conference in January. We had a legislative committee. We have nine districts in the state of Minnesota, and for those trivia people, they were set on the 1950 congressional boundaries in Minnesota. We had nine congressional reps in 1950, and we've just never changed them. They seem to work out very well for us. We had all districts present. We had a frank discussion, and the top three priorities were ending veteran homelessness, Veterans Court, which I believe we're going to hear today, and I can tell you the VFW is firmly behind the work that has been done with that and firmly behind these legislative efforts to keep that going and get Minnesota back to the top. And what we would really like to see is an omnibus veterans bill. Too often we see in the legislative process, bills come before this committee and your counterpart in the Senate and get sent on to someplace else to get attached to something that's controversial, and we end up with issues affecting veterans that for one reason or another end up with an unrelated bill and ending. It would be really nice if we could end up with a veterans omnibus bill where everything veteran related goes into one bill. Also a top priority was tax reform on charitable gaming. Many of our posts run charitable gaming, and as everyone knows, a large portion of that is taken out and was used to fund the Viking Stadium, and right now we're hearing projected surpluses in that, and it would be really nice to see an adjustment to that to make up for some of that surplus, and we can keep local dollars local. Money that's raised locally should be kept locally, and we would greatly appreciate that help too. And that's what I have.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. Any questions from the committee? I have one. You still sponsor VFW hockey?
Absolutely.
It's the greatest tournament in the world.
There's a this year's tournament is in Thief River Falls, the 23rd of March.
Okay.
That weekend, anyway. So if you want to see some good Bantam hockey, that's the place to be. I thank you so much for allowing us the time today.
Well, thank you for coming. I appreciate it. So.
If you guys just want to grab a seat. All right. Chair Eklund moves that House File 998 be recommended to pass. We refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Eklund, would you like to move your amendment to get the bill in proper shape?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the DE1 amendment.
All right. Chairman Eklund moves the DE1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And the DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Eklund, to your bill, as amended, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm excited to be working on the Veterans Defense Project on this important piece of legislation. This will be part of its, be the first of its kind in the country, and I'm incredibly proud to be carrying it. The DE1 amendment that I have authored gets the bill in the shape that I'd like it. The amendment does the following things. First, it modifies the criteria and process for determining a veteran's eligibility to participate under this statute. Number two, it clarifies sanctions available if a participating veteran violates the terms of probation. Number three, it clarifies the respective roles of the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. The bill before you, the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, provides a framework for Minnesota courts on sentencing a justice-involved veteran, which will ensure treatment for service-related disorders that lead to a criminal offense, while following the veteran the opportunity, while allowing the veteran the opportunity to fully reintegrate with the community without a record of conviction. It is not a free ride, as a veteran defendant will be required to submit to whatever rehabilitative efforts the court deems necessary to protect public safety. The language was developed through an 18-month collaboration of key Minnesota veterans criminal justice stakeholders. It adapts and improves on the best practices from Minnesota's other states' veterans courts and veterans sentencing statutes, including California Penal Code 1170.9, Texas Government Code Chapter 124, and the existing drug sentencing options of Minnesota Statute 152.18. I have with me a number of testifiers, and I would like to turn it over for that, over to them for the remainder of the presentation, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To testify, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brock Hunter. I'm an attorney and a veteran who spent the past 20 years defending psychologically injured veterans in the criminal courts. For the past decade, I have advocated for reforms in how the justice system deals with veterans, first here in Minnesota, and then on a national level, co-founding with Ryan Ilse the Veterans Defense Project, a public policy advocacy and education organization dedicated to ensuring that no veteran is left behind in the criminal justice system. Today, we face a growing storm of veterans flooding into our criminal justice system. After 17 years of continuous war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, the longest wars in our country's history, our military is under unprecedented strain. In Vietnam, the vast majority of our veterans served one 12-month tour. Contrast that to today, where two and three tours are commonplace and four, five, and six tours not unusual. Some have served even more. Marko Milosevic, who sits to my right and will be testifying shortly, served 12 combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan with the Army 75th Ranger Regiment. And he has friends still serving in Army Special Operations who are now over 20 combat deployments post 9/11. We have no precedence for this level of deployment in our country's history. Looking back at the aftermath of Vietnam, the VA estimates that a third to a half of Vietnam veterans suffered long-term psychological injuries related to their service, and half of those psychologically injured veterans had some contact with the criminal justice system. And when they did, the Department of Justice studies showed that Vietnam veterans were treated more harshly than civilians committing the same crimes during that era. Many Vietnam veterans have continued to struggle with chronic incarceration, homelessness, and addiction in the decades since that war. Some are still out there, left behind, living under bridges and cycling through the system. Predictably, the same cycle is repeating itself with this new generation of veterans. But the unprecedented length of these wars and the unprecedented repeated deployments mean higher rates of post-traumatic stress and criminal justice involvement for this generation than those after Vietnam. Though there is more help available for psychologically injured veterans today than ever before, many of those veterans do not seek that help out. Reasons for this are many, but a few of the top ones include what we call Superman syndrome, the byproduct of the military's intense training and conditioning and its proud warrior culture that leaves many veterans feeling that they should be able to handle their problems on their own and that failure to do so is failure as a warrior. Some psychologically injured veterans are resistant to treatment because it requires them to confront their demons, and they would rather self-medicate with alcohol or drugs than to do that hard work of confronting and putting those demons to rest. Some also suffer from survivor's guilt and believe that they don't deserve to get help and don't deserve to be happy in life because the buddies they left behind on the battlefields did not get that chance. And finally, some are angry. Angry at the government that sent them to war and the society that has ignored them upon their return home. It is often in the backseat of a squad car or in a cell at the county jail that we first identify a veteran in need of help. And for all of these reasons, the flow of veterans into our courts is steadily growing and will continue to do so in the years ahead. We can and we must do a better job this time around. 10 years ago, in 2008, I worked with Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman and his Chief Deputy Dave Brown and others to draft and pass Minnesota's original veteran sentencing statute, the first of its kind in the country. Our pioneering statute, which encourages treatment over incarceration for veterans whose criminal offense is tied to their service-related psychological injuries, has had a national impact on the veterans' criminal justice landscape over the past decade. It has served as a model for similar statutes in other states and was cited by the U.S. Supreme Court in its landmark decision of Porter v. McCollum, which helped launch the National Veterans Court movement. While Minnesota started out at the cutting edge on this national veterans justice movement, over the past few years, we have frankly fallen back in the pack. We are no doubt doing good things by our veterans in Minnesota, but our 12 veterans courts only serve a fraction of our 87 counties. And they use a variety of different models, some more effective than others. Some of our veterans courts are even shrinking at a time when the number of veterans flooding into our criminal courts is growing. The main reason for that is that some of our courts have been providing participants the opportunity to avoid a criminal conviction, while others are convicting veterans of their crimes, even if they do everything that's expected of them. Bill Ward, the state public defender, who you'll be hearing from shortly, even pulled all of his public defenders out of Minnesota's veterans courts 2 years ago over concerns for the lack of legal benefits afforded to the veterans in those courts. Meanwhile, across the country, many other states have much larger numbers of veterans courts in Minnesota, and our once pioneering statute has been surpassed by states like Texas and California that recently passed more sophisticated statutes that harness the hard lessons learned in the last decade on the front lines of veterans in the justice system. Thankfully, in 2017, the Minnesota legislature took a major step towards addressing these issues and provided a grant to the Veterans Defense Project to help our courts improve and expand the way we deal with our justice-involved veterans. Over the past year and a half, we have been working on several fronts to accomplish what we've come to call our Minnesota mission. The first front of that mission is the bill that stands before you for hearing today, what we call the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. Upon receiving our grant, our first step was to convene a working group of key criminal justice stakeholders. The members of our working group included judges from our largest, most established veterans courts, Mike Freeman and Dave Brown from Hennepin County, John Choi, the Ramsey County attorney, Pete Orpett, the Washington County attorney, Bill Ward, the state public defender, Evan Tsai, an assistant Ramsey County public defender in its veterans court, John Kingray, retired JAG colonel and former executive director of the County Attorneys Association, Ben Johnson from the State Department of Veterans Affairs, and David Holowinski from the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. This all-star team has been an intense collaboration on a monthly basis for the past year and a half, evaluating what is working and not working in Minnesota's veterans courts and looking beyond our borders at what's working best in other states. Next, we collaborated with the prosecutors and defense lawyers on the working group to draft the bill before you. This bill creates a framework based upon proven best practices to all judges in Minnesota, whether they have a veterans court or not, and they can immediately put it to use to effectively deal with veterans appearing before them. This bill provides veterans charged with certain crimes a path to redemption, restoration, and reintegration back into their communities by giving them an opportunity to avoid a criminal conviction. To be eligible, a veteran must be charged with a level 7 offense or lower, those offenses not presumptive commits to prison. To be eligible, a veteran must also demonstrate a nexus between the military service-related mental health or substance abuse issue and their charged offense. And upon acceptance into this program, the veteran must enter a guilty plea and take responsibility for themselves and their recovery by staying sober and abiding by all recommended treatment at the VA or other appropriate treatment provider. At the end of the process, the court may hold a hearing to hear from the prosecutor and the victim, if any, and determine whether the veteran has done everything expected of them. If the court determines that the veteran has upheld their end of the bargain and it is in the interests of public safety, the court may dismiss the charge and the veteran will emerge without a criminal record. This approach works because it recognizes the service and sacrifice of the veterans on behalf of their communities. It helps reestablish broken trust between these veterans and their government and their communities. It incentivizes a commitment to complete often difficult traumatic treatment, and it offers hope of redemption and the ability to once again be an asset and not an ongoing liability to the community the veteran once risked their life to protect. And finally, it better protects public safety in both the short and the long term. This bill, if signed into law, will put Minnesota back on the cutting edge of the national veterans justice movement. I have two veterans who have been through this process with different types of outcomes that I will introduce, but I believe Mike Freeman, the Hennepin County attorney, wants to jump up in line as he has to attend to an important matter, and so I'll turn the floor over to him.
Mr. Freeman, please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the chief author of this bill, Brock, and my colleague from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, Representative Jamie Becker Finn. It's an honor to be here. I recall about 20 years ago, I sat in this room all night when I was privileged to be the chair of the Senate side of a capital bonding bill.
I must say to you that this is a much more genteel meeting than that one was. But I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much. And I'm proud to be here, not only as the elected Hennepin County Attorney, but a proud veteran myself of the Vietnam era. We have a highly successful Veterans Court in Hennepin County, thanks in many ways to the work of Brock Hunter, because we have recognized that veterans deserve to have some special consideration in light of their service for this country. In the first 2 years of our Veterans Court, we had 53 felony referrals. 37 were accepted, 12 graduated, 20 at the time of this census were still involved under supervision. They came from referrals from our drug team, our property team, felony DWIs, terroristic threats, and serious assaults. Why special treatment? Well, as Brock has said, in the Vietnam era, we had one 12-month deployment and came home. Very few people stayed longer. Now, as you'll hear from these two vets of Afghanistan and Iraq, 3, 4, 5, 10, 12 deployments. They're shorter deployments usually, but that's an incredible sacrifice to this country. Under intense training and very difficult combat situations, it impacts people's lives profoundly, and we recognize that. The bill's provisions as set forth by your chairman and chief author are very similar to what we do in Hennepin County, and I can tell you I can vouch for the procedures there. It allows for stays of adjudication that provides maximum incentive for veterans to accept attendance as needed treatment, a suggestion brought by State Public Defender Bill Ward and one which I endorse. It's amazing sometimes defendants and prosecutors can get together on a good idea. The bill provides for a path for redemption and an access to VA services. It's cheaper and much more useful than merely simple incarceration. And we are all much safer when highly trained vets, trained to fight, are emotionally stable and chemically healthy. The fact that our government bears responsibility for the all-too-predictable issues that our troops bring home with them. When those issues lead to the criminal justice contact, our courts, in my view, bear a special responsibility to constructively address rather than blindly punish them. Failure to effectively address our veterans in the justice system and to reintegrate these veterans back into our communities will inevitably lead to escalating public health and public safety risks. We owe it to our vets, and we owe it to the community. And as a prosecutor is designed to provide public safety, I can endorse this without reservation. Now, later on, you're going to hear an appropriation bill. And having been the vice chair of the Finance Committee, I tread testifying about finances carefully. But I can tell you, having worked with Brock and his team, these dollars that you appropriated 2 years ago have been wisely used, and the new increases are necessary to complete the project. Mr. Chairman and members, this bill calls for justice and hope for our veterans. It calls for alternative incarceration for those who have served our country well. It saves money, provides for public safety, and just makes sense. Mr. Chairman, I urge its adoption.
Thank you. Next testifier, please identify yourself for the record.
If I may introduce Mr. Milosevic, Mr. Chair. Marco Milosevic is a former client of ours and now works with us as an advocate at the Veterans Defense Project. As I said earlier, Marco has the distinction of serving 12 combat deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly a record within our office. Marco served with the Army's Elite 75th Ranger Regiment, often on missions that were being followed closely by the President and the leaders of the Department of Defense. He was even on a mission in which one of his teammates earned the Congressional Medal of Honor, one of a handful of living soldiers to earn such a distinction during these conflicts. And when Marco got out after 13 years of service and 12 deployments, medically discharged, as he says, mentally and physically broken, he was handed a flag and sent home. And he fell into all of the kinds of trouble that we've been talking about. joined an outlaw motorcycle club and got himself into a significant amount of trouble. When we came into contact with Marco in Beltrami County facing a felony domestic assault case, they had no precedence for this kind of case and had no veterans court to deal with him. We spent the next year educating Marco, the judge, the prosecutor, and everybody else involved. And the result that he got mirrors very closely the bill before you. He was sent to treatment where he was held accountable. He got clean. He got sober. And he was given an opportunity to avoid a criminal conviction on his record, an opportunity that I believe he will tell you made all the difference for him. And with that, I'll turn it over to Marco.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thanks for having me here today. My name is Marco Milosevic. It's good to see some of you again. I know I spoke to some of you a couple years ago around this time. Like Brock said, I was in the 75th Ranger Regiment. I did 12 combat deployments. I joined the Army when I was 17 in April of 2001, right before 9/11. I was essentially going to do my 4 years, get my college money, and go on with my life. And just as it went, I was in airborne school when 9/11 happened, and a member of the 75th Ranger Regiment came around, and he was a recruiter, and they needed people because they were getting ready to deploy shortly. And his recruiting spiel was simple. He said, "Who wants to go to war and kill people?" And at 18 years old, I rose my hand. I was angry. I was upset at what had happened because of 9/11. That was a lot of us were that upset. And I went. And shortly, I hadn't even completed all my training, and I was sent on my very first deployment around November, December-ish of 2001, one of the first things over there. Like Brock said, I came and went 12 separate times. And every time I came home, I felt less and less a part of this world. My mission while I was over there was to do direct action raids to kill or capture high-value targets, so the guys that go to Gitmo, essentially, and places like that. I also did one deployment more covertly where it was me and one other American service member kind of out doing stuff on our own, and I can't really get into what that entailed. But needless to say, it was hairy, as they call it in the military. And after all those 12 combat deployments, essentially I had learned one tool. From the age of 17 to 31, which is the dates I was, or my ages when I was in the military, I only needed one tool in my toolbox to solve my problems, and that tool was violence. The only problem I had was people were trying to kill me, and the only solution was to either capture them or do the same before they could do it to me. When I got to get out of the military, I didn't want to go. I reenlisted indefinitely to do my 20 years, my sergeant major took one look at me and essentially could see in my eyes that I was broken and needed a break. I was physically also incapable of just meeting the standards, not only to be in a special operations unit, but just to be in the military. I've had about 9 or 10 surgeries, some of them due to shrapnel, some of them due to overuse. And I'm only 35. Last time, actually, my knee was cut open. The orthopedic surgeon said he'd been doing surgeries for 30 years and said he hadn't seen a knee like that in a while. So I don't know if that says something about the rigorousness of being in the special operations. But like Brock alluded to, when I got out, I got a pat on the back and an American flag, and I was sent on my way. And I was pretty disillusioned that after 13 and a half years of service to my country, that's what I got. And I remember going out into the parking lot. I just signed all my out processing paperwork. They took my ID card, and I was to leave base within 24 hours is kind of the rule they set for you. And I broke down in the parking lot. I cried. I don't want to say I cried. I wept for an hour or two. And I remember watching new service members go into the you out process the same area you in process. And I remember them going in to in process and just sort of shaking my head, you know, at these. I mean, these were 18-year-old kids. You know, they look like kids. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, I was one of them, and the excitement on my face, you know, getting to go off and have an adventure and serve your country. I felt like when I was used up, they just threw me away. And like I said, there was no sort of breaking you back down and reintegrating you. When you join the military, they break you down, right? And then they build you back up the way they want you. And when you go to get out of the military, there's not much of that. And so I had essentially been taking prescription pills that were prescribed to me while I was in the military and drinking along with those prescription pills. When those ended, I started looking for my drugs and my self-medicating elsewhere. And that kind of ran me into contact with some unsavory characters. And I started making wrong decisions then. And in an effort to get away from all that, I moved to the state of Minnesota. I stopped doing drugs, but I still had the drinking habit. And that eventually wound up to a pretty steep confrontation between me and my wife at the time. Well, she's still my wife. I wound up getting arrested for a felony domestic assault. And while I was sitting in that jail cell, I realized that this is not who I am. This is not the type of guy I had been for the past, my whole military career. I had almost checked every box of what you can do in the military, and here I am now sitting in this jail cell, and I was angry. I was angry that the very government, the Constitution that I had sworn to uphold and defend, was now being used against me to prosecute me in a way. And it just made me bitter and it made me angry, and that's when I came into contact with Mr. Hunter here. And that process he talked about, that learning curve, not only for the court, was also a learning curve for me. And I came to a lot of self-realizations in that process. And I went and got some treatment. The biggest thing I say that would help me the most is I got into what's called the Domestic Abuse Project. And they had a program there that's geared towards veterans. Where I went, my wife also went, and then we went collectively together. And I would say that program alone probably saved our marriage, saved our relationship. Since completing all the things the court put on me, what is the word I'm looking for there? The requirements that the court put on me. Thank you. I have been going to college. I have around a 3.7 GPA. My wife has been attending nursing school. I've also volunteered with a bunch of different nonprofits, including the Veterans Defense Project. I also work with the Freedom Alliance, which is out of Washington, D.C. area. I help do fishing trips and treatments, readjustment trips, as they like to call them, sort of reintegration trips, fishing trips, hunting trips, things like that with other veterans to get them plugged back into society. I've been doing some advocacy work along with U.S. Bank, who has a big veterans hiring initiative. And I've done some speaking at different VAs and different veterans organizations across the state of Minnesota. Oftentimes when I speak, inevitably there will be a judge or a sheriff or some sort of law enforcement agent present. And I always ask them if they've ever thanked a veteran for their service. And they usually say, yeah, of course we have. And I'll say, then here's a chance to really thank a veteran for their service and give them a second chance that they deserved since they fought for their country and they served honorably. And I just want to end with a quote by Pete Orpett over there, who says it's all about doing the right thing for the right people. And if we have that mentality, we can do a lot for veterans. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll introduce Mr. Miller. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd also like to introduce Tony Miller, another justice-involved veteran. Tony served as a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne, serving two very intense combat deployments in Iraq, including during the surge. Tony returned home with post-traumatic stress issues and found himself charged with the possession of a relatively small amount of marijuana, around 3 ounces. But because the court that he was, the county in which he participated in Veterans Court at the time did not offer stays of adjudication, he completed everything that was expected of him, but nonetheless walked away with a conviction. And he's here to tell you his story.
Thanks, Brock. Good afternoon. My name is Tony Miller, and I'm a graduate of Veterans Court. I was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne, and I served in the 1st of the 325th. Airborne Infantry Regiment. I served 2 tours of combat in Iraq, with my first tour falling under the Joint Special Operations Command, where our unit was decorated with a Valorous Unit Award. My second tour in Iraq was with the 2nd Infantry Brigade Combat Team. We were the first boots on the ground for the surge, and again we received a Valorous Unit Award. Currently, I'm in my senior year of the BSW program at Metro State, where I maintain a 4.0 GPA, and next year I will attend St. Thomas for my Master's in Social Work, with an area of emphasis on military practice. Today we're meeting to discuss the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, and I'm honored to participate in this extraordinary measure. This act aims to eliminate sentencing disparities across Minnesota and apply a uniform standard for guidelines that will be fair for all veterans, safe for our community, and above all, improve our country's promise to care for our veterans when they return home from war. I'd like to start by giving you some background on how I ended up in Veterans Court and how the experience has helped me become a better veteran. But to properly articulate the transformation I made while in Veterans Court and the challenges I still struggle with and the obstacles in my future, I'd like to offer some quick context as to what led me here today. My second tour in Iraq came 16 days after I redeployed back to Fort Bragg from my previous deployment. The second BTC was slated for deployment to facilitate the surge, and with less than a month home with our families, we were all pretty upset about being back in Iraq so soon. As I flew back to Iraq, I struggled with emotions that I can only describe as a cancer diagnosis. How much longer do I have to live? My fear quickly turned to anger and frustration. Our deployment had a clear mission, and we were very orientated on a specific province with a specific goal to accomplish. It wasn't an easy deployment by any means, and we took casualties in our ranks, especially our mortars platoon. But it was a clean deployment. Our second deployment seemed to lack the vision of the first. Our role was constantly changing along with our leadership. We mostly helped the Iraqi police with training and securing neighborhoods in Baghdad. We lived in an old abandoned Iraqi Air Force base that was comprised of three buildings surrounded by a barrier of HESCO fencing. Infighting within the Iraqi police was constant, and it only worsened our situation. In my anger, I found myself asking, why am I even here and what am I accomplishing? I want to be home with my family. Why can't the Iraqi police get their act together? Is this even worth it anymore? After a particular day of police infighting that sent all the Iraqis home, a man approached our compound with a mangled child's body. A local militia had tied his son to a tree, burned him with cigarettes, and shot him with an RPG. This man was willing to bring us to the house of these men and point out individuals and give us information on the people who murdered his son. This was valuable intel to us, but it was a death sentence for him. I'll never forget that man's face or the sacrifices that he made in the name of justice. My attitude completely changed as I listened to the interpreter explain what happened to that man's son. My anger subsided and my empathy took over. I knew I had a specific skill set that could ease this man's suffering. I could push my mind and my body to unknown limits to complete a task given to me. I was swift, determined, and courageous. I did not yield to weakness, to hunger, to cowardice, or to superior odds. I was mentally tough, physically strong, and morally straight, and if I could help one man, then it was worth it. When I got out of the Army, I was disillusioned with civilian life. I found no joy bouncing at hockey pubs and decided to head to college to pursue a degree in environmental geology and eventually seek employment in the Forest Department in northern Minnesota. I thought a college education was my ticket away from civilians and all the drama they seemed to bring. In 2015, one afternoon on my way to school, I heard a man call my name and I turned around to a pistol in my face. I didn't know if I'd hear a gunshot, but I did hear the handcuffs. After my home was turned upside down and approximately 78 grams of cannabis were found strewn throughout my house, I was charged with fifth-degree felony possession of marijuana. I was also a legal gun owner at the time, and the fact that I had guns in my home, along with 2 ounces of marijuana, opened the doors for prosecutors to seek a 3-year prison term unless I pled guilty to my first and last felony and attended and successfully completed Veterans Court. My arrival at Veterans Court mirrored my second deployment to Iraq. I was very angry and frustrated. I had been forced from my home when I was arrested since I lived in St. Louis Park. A disgraced narcotic officer, Travis Serafin, was heavily involved in my case. And 3 months after my guilty plea, cannabis was approved for medical use for PTSD in Minnesota. The same questions began to swirl in my mind. Why am I even here? Minnesota allows cannabis for PTSD. I have to pay $20 for parking every time I come downtown. And this all fueled my anger over the situation that I had gotten myself into. I would often waste large amounts of time obsessing over how unfair it was that a man could abuse his wife and receive a misdemeanor while I received a felony for possession of marijuana. These feelings that I have were very apparent to the court staff. Tony's got an edge on him, some of the staff would say, and my probation officer, retired Sergeant Major Chuck Decker, helped to reassure the court staff by letting him know he's an airborne guy, they're kind of like that, it's okay. I can't stress enough how important it was for me as a veteran to have Chuck as a probation officer. When I found out that he was a retired Command Sergeant Major, I knew that I had a battle buddy again, something that I had not had in years. His advice was invaluable for me. I had come to a point where I thought my life was over and would be ruined forever by this blemish on my record. Chuck said to me, "You're a paratrooper. You're from the school of hard knocks, the last of a dying breed. If I had ever needed again to hear the words, take a knee, face out, pull security, and drink water, I needed it from Chuck, and I needed it then. Veterans need other veterans. We have our own language, our own communities, and our own culture. Veterans know what veterans need. So I pulled myself up, dusted the dirt off my face, and got back to school. I needed to prove to myself that I wasn't done, and I had plenty left in my gas tank. One Monday morning in Vets Court, I observed a fellow veteran getting ready to spend a few days in jail for the results of a UA. This veteran was struggling with a methamphetamine addiction and living out of his car. He was afraid that his car would be towed, and it had all his possessions inside. He'd asked the judge if he could relocate his car to a safer place before he went back to jail, but there was no mentorship program at the time, and he was remanded into custody. I talked to Chuck after court and voiced my concerns for veterans in situations like this. I mentioned that I thought Veterans Court would benefit from a mentorship program. I didn't know it at the time, but this was the first time I would advocate for a veteran. I discussed with Chuck how the day's events in court had affected me, and he suggested I talk to someone about a BSW program. Chuck advocated for me and got me in touch with Dr. Neil Tao, who is the program director for the BSW program at Metro State and is currently my academic advisor. I discussed this option with someone who I have great respect for, and we came to a mutual consensus that, felon or not, I was made for veterans advocacy. We discussed the barriers that I will inevitably encounter when applying for graduate school, taking state licensing exams, and applying for jobs. And for all the doubts that I have about my felony and how much it will hinder me, even to this very day, this unsung hero reminds me that this felony is not my weakness, it's my strength. Mark and I have a lot in common. Admittedly, he is much cooler than myself. But we both like jumping out of perfectly good airplanes, and we're both combat veterans. But our crimes and punishment differ, though, markedly. Marco's crime was more serious than mine. Marco was given a second chance while I took one for the team. But we have both thrived. We both see the need for veterans advocacy, and we both are committed to pave the way for veterans that will inevitably follow in our footsteps. Veterans Court reaffirmed strengths in myself that I thought I had lost forever. I will continue to advocate for veterans, military personnel, and their families, not for myself, but for my battle buddies. Battle buddies that I lost in Iraq, battle buddies that I've lost to suicide, and battle buddies that are still struggling today. I forsake not my comrades or my sacred duty. Always I fight on, through the foe, to the objective, to triumph overall. In closing, I'd like to talk about rattlesnakes. Rattlesnakes can produce enough venom in a single strike to kill a human and easily kill any small prey. But when they are disputing in the wild, they resort to a form of wrestling. It's a strange thing to see. Why don't they just bite each other and kill one another? Buried deep in their dinosaur brains is that preservation of the species. As animals, we have an innate resistance to kill our own species. When soldiers are trained to go to war, they are trained to ignore this automatic repulsion to kill one another. An effective soldier needs to be able to kill another human without hesitation. We are conditioned over time to overcome this resistance to kill. What does this do to our minds? Can we heal from this? I believe that the answer is yes. Minnesota is leading the pack with Veterans Affairs. We have one of the nicest VA hospitals in the country. We have a governor that is a veteran who understands veterans' issues. And we have lawmakers who know that veterans need understanding and compassion to assimilate back into the civilian world. I will continue to be optimistic about my future and the future of Veterans Court. Thank you for your time here and allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Representative Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Tommy and Marco, thank you both. Thank you both very much. Just a couple questions for Mr. Hunter in our chair, please.
Go ahead, Mr. Russell.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Who would provide? I guess you mentioned, Mr. Hunter. You mentioned that something about Bemidji, and that was where Marco was from. Who would provide the programming to veterans who are entered into the diversion program in a small rural community?
Mr. Hunter.
Representative, the answer to that is primarily the Department of Veterans Affairs and their branch offices. I believe in Bemidji, they're oriented towards the Fargo-Moorhead area.
Yep.
And they have smaller outreach centers. But there are going to be times and places in which we have to go beyond the VA to local community treatment providers as well. and you know, as the courts do with anyone else coming through with mental health or substance abuse issues. But the lion's share of the treatment is going to be provided by the federal VA.
I thought there was something going to be added there.
I was just going to say that oftentimes there are programs set up within the VA healthcare system. I went to St. Cloud, but also there are programs that they can refer you to that are often at little to no charge to the veteran. For example, the program I mentioned, the Domestic Abuse Project, was at no charge to myself, and I went every week for 6 months along with my spouse. So that's there's tons out there.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Go ahead, sir.
I'd also add, we have two more brief testifiers, Washington County Attorney Pete Orpit and State Public Defender Bill Ward, who I believe wanted to offer some brief comments.
I guess just to finish up on that question, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Representative.
As far as being diverted to other programs, are those other programs equipped to meet the needs of our gentleman here, who are in this, unique circumstances?
Whenever and wherever possible, Mr. Representative, we always advocate that the VA is the first point of contact for treatment. They are uniquely suited to treat veterans with combat trauma, no doubt about it.
Your testifier, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Ward. I'm the State Public Defender for Minnesota. For those of you who I do not know and have not met, as an understanding, my agency represents individuals, the individual accused of all, in all 87 counties in Minnesota. We represent over 150,000 clients or cases with clients every single year. 90% of those are the felony cases represent, over 60% of all misdemeanors, over 80% of gross misdemeanor cases, as well as over 90% of juvenile delinquency cases. As Brock mentioned earlier, I am that person who pulled us out of Veterans Court and other treatment courts in this state. It is a fact. We are understaffed and under-resourced. That is a fact. And ultimately, as a constitutionally mandated agency, I, with the Board of Public Defense, have to make a decision as to where we allocate our resources. I firmly believe in some treatment courts, they do very well. I appreciate the comments by Mike Freeman earlier. I've known him for a long time. I was the chief public defender in Hennepin County. As Mr. Orpert will tell you, because I was there when he designed the Veterans Court in the late 2000s, it was what should have been a model court, in that they accepted individuals who should be admitted and ultimately were offered a stay of adjudication. That treatment court, like many treatment courts in the state, they kind of lose their way over time. It depends on culture, depends on staffing, and depends on recommendations of the county attorneys. So I have to make a determination as to who or should not be in these programs, not necessarily. The determination is, when I only have X amount of dollars, how do I spend that money and those human resources? I believe in treatment courts. I believe in what they can accomplish. They are not the panacea, which is what I like about this bill. Ultimately, I firmly believe, as everybody else testified, that our veterans do deserve that second chance. And this bill attempts to accommodate not just a second chance, but given the resources and ultimately the human support so people can achieve success. When Mr. Hunter contacted me about being a part of this process with the initial funding, to say I was reluctant is an understatement at most, or at least. Basically, I'm the guy who pulled us out of him. You know, why would I be a part of this process? It's because we do believe in it, but ultimately I firmly believe that if someone is putting that time and energy into addressing the underlying issues as to why they are in the court system, a veteran should get the opportunity of not having that collateral consequence. I don't like the word collateral consequence because a felony conviction ruins people's lives. The fact that we have two folks sitting right next to each other have different results based upon Veterans Court is embarrassing, it's egregious, and it's fundamentally unfair, period. This bill addresses that. It doesn't say you have to have 87 veteran courts in this state. It says if someone is charged with this offense, that they should be able to take advantage and should take advantage of this change in the statute. That means, as Representative Grossel asked about the resources, that means using the VA to find those resources. As you know, we've talked about this. I know those resources aren't out there in so many of our counties that just do not have the funding. However, the VA is there for their folks, and they are able and are willing to support and provide the resources to get folks to deal with the underlying issues. I fully support this bill in the way it's been designed. I can't tell you how many different revisions we went through, how many wordsmiths have gone through. We've had some loud discussions and words, and I'm very proud that Representative Eklund, that you've taken this thing on as the chair. A couple other brief comments. To say that the resources that you provided were used wisely and efficiently and in the right direction, again, is another understatement. Mr. Hunter put together, he called them, these expert heads. I would not call myself that, but certainly provided a voice that knows what works on the ground. I know what happens in these courtrooms. It's not from a 10,000-foot level. Mr. Orpik knows what happens in these courtrooms. We understand what decisions are made and what the effect is going to be. That's how that your funding has been used. That's how it will continue to be used in the future through training my folks, through training the criminal court players in all different counties, and ultimately, if this bill is passed, making sure that people understand what it means, how it can be used, so you don't have what happened to these two individuals and how they were treated fundamentally unfair from one another in this state.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. Chair Eklund, do you have another testifier?
Pardon me? Oh, I have a hard time hearing.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, sir. I'm Pete Orpik. I'm the Washington County Attorney. I formerly served in the Marine Corps from 1973 to 76. Before I begin, Mr. Chair, I did want to ask if I could address Representative Detmer. I was greatly honored that he came to my Veterans Court, such as it is, a couple of weeks ago to see graduations. I was touched. Every one of my four veterans who graduated was touched. It meant a lot. And I just wanted to thank him publicly for that. The one thing I do want to also thank Mr. Ward for is when he pulled all his public defenders out of veterans courts, he didn't pull them out of mine. And I was not only grateful thinking, well, there, I dodged a bullet, but when I talked to Bill and said, what's going on? Well, just a very few courts have the model right. And I go, well, I don't know if I have it right or not. I only know what drove me to do it. So backing up in 2010, I'd known Brock, Hunter, and a few others. It was just a small group of us. I'm a prosecutor in Hennepin County, and I'm seeing person after person come through that had served in combat and now had problems. And so Brock and I sat down with a few others and said, let's put something together. And it started to work, and immediately I left thereafter and became elected. The very first thing I did when I got in Washington County is going, I'm setting one up here. I didn't ask anybody for a nickel. I just did it. And when I hear someone like Tony talk and say he walked away with a felony, it breaks my heart. That's not who we are as prosecutors. You know, the way I look at this is a moral imperative. We send these troops, and by the way, women too. I've had two women in my program, victims of military sexual trauma, and it mimics the same thing as combat. But these people didn't go in the service a criminal. They couldn't. You couldn't get in with a DWI today. So they didn't go in as a criminal. Why are we seeing them in vast numbers in court? Because we broke them. And we broke them and discard them and say, there you go, have a nice day. And we did that with my friends, my Vietnam vet friends. And what's that resulted in? What, today, 28 active and released servicemen kill themselves a day. 28. That's an epidemic. That's an outrage. So I can't save the world, but if I can get one or two Marcos or Tonys, that's good enough for me. And one more thing I want to testify to is when you gave some money in 2017 for the Veterans Defense Project, I was grateful. I came down and testified, and I can tell you what it's meant. Giving a small amount of money to Brock and Ryan and Don, they've put on training for all my staff, all the judges in Washington County, and most importantly, they've gone out and trained my law enforcement officers, and they become my biggest ally in these courts. This isn't a hug-a-thug program. This is do the right thing to the right person at the right time. And when it doesn't happen, it hurts, because I don't think that's the way us prosecutors ought to be standing. And this bill will take care of that. It will do the right thing to the right. But they have to want it. They have to want it. I can't make somebody weigh 900 pounds. I can't make them go through the treatment. But I've partnered with the Veterans Administration. I used to have my criticisms of them. Now I don't. Now I do not. I have Veterans Justice Outreach people working closely with me. And then I bring my mentors in, and we've seen miracles. And it's worth it to me. And so I'm in here in support, and I want to thank Mr. Chair next to me and for considering this bill and also for funding the Veterans Defense Project. That's a buck well spent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Dittmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have just a few questions here, and probably for Mr. Hunter. Again, this is a good bill. I think I'm number two on your bill, Mr. Chair. And I think, but I have a few questions here. And what happens to the defendant's record if he or she successfully completes the program? And what happens to their record?
Sir, Mr. Chair, Representative Dittmer, the mechanism that we are using in this bill is a stay of adjudication. This is a mechanism that's long been on the books in Minnesota. And what it involves is the individual, in this case a veteran, entering a guilty plea at the beginning of the process, but that plea is not formally accepted and the conviction is not entered. Instead, as we often explain to our clients, the judge takes the plea and puts it in their pocket, puts the veteran on probation with all of these conditions and accountability. And then in our bill, at the end of the process, there is a hearing, and the judge hears from the prosecutor. If there's a victim, hears from the victim if they wish to be heard, and assesses how the veteran has performed during their time on probation. And if the judge determines that the veteran upheld their end of the bargain and that public safety is served, the judge takes that plea out of their pocket and tears it up or vacates it, and the charge against the veteran is dismissed. The beauty of a stay of adjudication is that the veteran is not convicted of a crime either during the pendency of the process or in the aftermath once the case is dismissed. They keep their record clean. No conviction is ever entered, and it is much easier, as we always say, to keep that genie in the bottle rather than let him out and try to shove it back in later. And that's the mechanism and the way that it works.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you know, as Mr. Orpitz said, I got to sit in on the Washington County courts, and it was just a great experience. I also sat in on Hennepin County Court also. So, and they're different. The courts are different. Another question. How would the county or city veterans pretrial diversions programs be funded?
Oh, may I answer that?
Yes.
When I set up my program, Representative Dittmer, the biggest sales point to my county boards, I'm fiscally conservative too, and I said, but here's the thing, folks, the VA picks it all up. Now, it's still my tax money and yours too, but they're the ones who know how to do it, and they do it well. So it's not borne by city and county taxpayers. And I don't know if they could. This treatment sometimes is intensive, and you need to know what you're doing, and we've had great success through the VA. So I'd say it's a big plus for localities to partner with the VA and get these people treated, because like we've heard earlier, this is a public safety issue. And there's nothing more safe for me than having a veteran who's gone through the program and worked and is working a program.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Another follow-up. Has the Minnesota County Attorneys Association taken a position on this bill?
It's pending before our board meeting. The Criminal Law Committee went through it and vetted it just this week. And on Friday, I hope to get the imprimatur of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association behind this entire bill. I hope to, represent Dittmer, and I expect to.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Orpitt, make sure you mention to them that this committee supports what we're doing here, too.
I'd be grateful to do that, yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Dittmer. I'd be much grateful to be able to tell them.
And another question here is, how does the Veteran Offender Restorative Justice Act mesh up with the judicial branch statewide standards?
I guess I'm not sure what specific standards you're referring to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dittmer, what you're talking, I'm guessing, is about case processing, right?
Right.
As I've said before, I think that the case processing standards are not taking into consideration individuals. Ultimately, the court has made determinations from 1980 as to what time period should or should not expire before a case is resolved. The reality here is that in any treatment court, and I know the courts have come to this body asking for additional funding for treatment courts, there is an understanding that if someone is in a treatment court, it is going to take a longer period of time for that individual to hopefully graduate. The idea behind treatment courts is that you're not treating a one-size-fits-all mentality. What you're doing is you're treating the individual, understanding that there is relapse, understanding that there are hurdles, that there is tripping and falling. And the idea is with the appropriate players, both the court, the judge, the folks who are staffing these meetings, they understand that individual, they understand what the layers are that they're dealing with, and there's also understanding that, yes, this case may be taking longer than your quote-unquote typical theft case or domestic case, but public safety demands that we take our time and demands that we support and encourage and hope for that people graduate. So, yes, it will take longer than your average case, but that's to be expected.
Mr. Chair, and I think some of these, if Mr. Orpit could mention, some of them go on for 2 years, right? They're in the program for two or more years, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, it depends on their needs. Some of them, we've seen some just tragic cases of people coming back. That takes time. We don't give up on them, neither do our mentors. And yes, for some it's taken 2 years, some a little longer. And very few it doesn't work for. But I'm very loath to give up on them until I've really run through all my options.
And Mr. Chair, finally working through my questions. If this bill is enacted, is it going to relieve the pressure on the veterans' courts, or is it going to enhance it, or what will it do?
I could argue for that. I won't see any more Tonys, Representative Detmer. I won't see Tonys. And hopefully I'll see Marcos, and everybody that comes through is going to get the help they need, not a felony conviction. A felony conviction hurts them. They didn't have it coming, and that's why I'm so reluctant to give them one. They really got to earn a felony out of me if they're acting out from their combat service. That needs to be taken care of. And this assures that everyone will get an opportunity to do the work and not have a felony.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, right? Yep. To address the first part of your question is, if in fact this bill is passed, I suspect that there will be more people in veterans courts because my folks will recommend that they go into veterans court. It's difficult for me now as a lawyer, as a criminal defense lawyer, forgetting about being the head of the agency, but as a criminal defense lawyer, for me to recommend someone to go into a quote-unquote treatment court when they get no benefit from the time they're putting into it. I know it sounds counterintuitive, but ultimately I have to look at probation violations. If they are going to fail, I'm setting them up for prison. So ultimately we don't recommend if you're not getting a stay of adjudication. If this bill passes and there is a stay of adjudication that's there, as Pete often says, hanging over their head, there will be certainly more of us recommending folks take advantage of the resources that are available to them. So initially, yes. Long-term, I agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Orpit. Long-term, I truly believe that we have less people in the court system as a result of participating and graduating in a good veterans program.
Okay. Mr. Chair, maybe just not a question, but a statement, maybe a challenge to everybody that serves on this committee is to, if you can make an appointment to sit in on a veterans court, do it. I just think it would be worth your while. You get to sit right next to the judge, and you get to see firsthand what goes on in the court, and it's it's an eye-opening experience that you listen to the judge talk about the cases, and then especially the graduations. I think when I attended Washington County, I think you had three graduations that day. And four graduations, you gave him a certificate. I think you gave him a coin too, and a handshake. It's a good experience. And I think if you serve in this committee, you should try to sit in on a veterans court. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we have one more bill to hear, and so if you can keep your questions relevant to the bill, the next person is Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question relates to what you had talked about earlier in your testimony. You had mentioned a whole bunch of groups that were part of this this bill, and I guess my concerns, my red flags on this were that they are the majority of the folks that had conversations or at least enacted this bill, created this bill, were from the metro area. And so I represent Greater Minnesota. I come from representing Blue Earth County, Nicola County, who doesn't have a restorative justice program. And I know in the 5th Judicial District, there are six other counties that do have a program. And just speaking a little bit about Blue Earth County, they've had 54 graduates, 26 currently enrolled folks, or 26 participants right now. And they started this program 5 years ago, and I would say that they've had success, 54 graduates. And so my biggest concern is that will this bill do anything to change how they are participating in their functions in Greater Minnesota? And I guess the other question I had was, have you consulted with other programs across Minnesota besides just in the metro area to see what works, what doesn't work, and recommendations for how things could be better?
Mr. Chair and Representative Brand, absolutely. We have been involved in helping organize most of the veterans courts across Minnesota, including those outside of the metro. We have great contacts in the Blue Earth County multi-county veterans court, one of the models we think that will work best for rural Minnesota. But we recognize there are still a lot of counties that have nothing going on at all. And that is really what is most exciting to me about this bill, is it will immediately provide empowerment and a structure to any judge in any county in Minnesota who has an individual veteran in front of them to look at this law and immediately start implementing these best practices and start doing better by that veteran. Now, over time, if that judge in that county finds that they have a critical mass of veterans coming through their system, they may choose to have a veterans protocol like Pete Orpitz in Washington County, sort of the first step towards a veterans court, and then ultimately down the road, maybe a full-blown veterans treatment court with all bells and whistles. But what this statute does more than anything is immediately helps the courts start saving the lives of the veterans that are coming through their courts today. And it immediately provides them a framework and empowers them to start helping right out of the gates.
Governor Brian.
Okay. Just the last thing I'd like to do is I'd just like to make a statement. Thank you very much, guys, for being here today, and thank you for having the voice and standing up. It's really important that the world hears your story.
Representative Jamie Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this actually kind of goes off Representative Brand's comments, but specifically I was wondering, you know, it allows any court but doesn't require courts to make use of the tools that we're putting out here. And I think, I mean, I'm going to sign on. It sounds really great, but, you know, especially in light of our discussion yesterday and the higher percentage of Native folks who are also veterans, you know, again, if we're talking about the metro area, we're not talking about necessarily our tribal communities. And, you know, those folks then might not be accessing the benefits to keeping those things off their records and having access to the treatment. And so, you know, in light of it being something that's allowed but not required, is part of the plan to do some outreach, to do some education so that the judges who see more tribal members and Native folks and other populations where we have a higher percentage of veterans are educated about why they should do this. And maybe it's not just coming from the public defenders, but coming from another source ahead of time so they know that's an option.
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, that is a great question. And to be clear, the language of our statute requires courts to follow this protocol if a veteran meets the criteria under the statute, the right type of offense and a demonstrated nexus between military service and their crime. But yes, education will be absolutely required, and the appropriation bill up next would fund the Veterans Defense Project for 2 more years to help roll out this statute, among other outreach efforts, to make sure that the courts understand it, support it, and use it as it's intended.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I may say, I mean, that was my critical concern about being on this committee, was outstate Minnesota. I mean, Scott Kutcher is in the 5th District. I'm well aware as to how those programs work. Again, whether I like it or not, I'm the head of an agency that represents people in 87 counties here. So It is critical that the folks in my agency are educated on this issue. They are now. Brock's been to our training. That part of it's not an issue. If, in fact, this bill is passed, we will have additional education to make sure that we affect change in the culture. It's not going to happen overnight. I know the cultures of these counties. It's not going to happen, but that's the goal. And if in fact, it's not being followed, I have to figure out other ways of making sure that, this law is, in fact, followed by the courts.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the sake of time, if Mr. Hunter can just come find the time to come to my office, I'll ask him my questions there.
All right, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 998? Please come identify yourself for the record.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And in the pursuit of brevity, I will just say that Governor Walz is supportive of this initiative. MDVA is supportive of this initiative. I've been proud to be a part of the working group developing this language and look forward to supporting this. I'd also like to note for the record that the County Veterans Service Officers Association is aware of this language. They are very supportive of the outcomes that are being sought. They are obviously concerned about any additional costs associated with staffing these kinds of initiatives. So wanted to note that for the record. But we are supportive and look forward to watching this down the line. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. So Representative Eklund.
This is just a great bill, Mr. Chair, and I hope that we can pass it and move it on to Ways and Means.
Representative Eklund renews his motion to House File 998 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means with the recommendation that it be sent to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
Members, I apologize for that taking so long, but I think it's an important bill. If we could have a little bit of leeway to go a few minutes over with members on the committee, I'd appreciate the 2 minutes to Representative Grasso. Talk fast, gentlemen. So. All right, next bill up, Representative Zhang, Veterans Defense Project Grant, funding provided, money appropriated. Representative Zhang moves that House File 430 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. There is an author's amendment. Representative Zhang, would you like to move that amendment now?
Yes, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Representative Zhang moves the A3 amendment. Is there any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed nay. Motion prevails and A3 is adopted. Representative Zhang, two-year bill.
Mr. Chair, members, this is an author's amendment in the first committee, but I'm going to give you a little explanation. First, it keeps the Humanities Center as the fiscal agent for the project. The Department of Veterans requested this. The Humanities Center was and has been the fiscal agent for the project since its inception. Both the Minnesota Humanities Center and the Department of Veterans Affairs are supportive of this change. And the second, the language was stricken that references legal assistance. We just wanted to make clear that the Veterans Defense Project will not be providing direct legal representation for individual veterans, but instead will be supporting justice-involved veterans through public education, outreach, and legal training to the Minnesota criminal justice system. For the past 2 years, the Veterans Defense Project has been conducting outreach and education to the public and criminal justice stakeholders to better understand and serve psychologically injured veterans in the criminal justice system. They have made a great deal of progress towards that goal, but the mission is not complete.
So this appropriation will allow them to complete that mission, and I have Mr. Brock Hunter here who will explain what the resources will be used for and testifiers here who are in support of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my testifiers that we had lined up for this have already essentially weighed in, I think, as part on the appropriation as part of their testimony on the earlier bill, so we will make this quite quick. As I said earlier, our Minnesota mission has been fought on several fronts. The first of them was the Veterans Restorative Justice Act and the working group that you just heard all about, so I won't belabor that point. But quickly, other things that we have done with the funding under the past 2 years grant. Our second front was a statewide education outreach. We have taught 20 legal education seminars statewide, reaching approximately 1,000 criminal justice stakeholders across Minnesota during the past 18 months. These include judges, prosecutors, public and private lawyers, court staff, probation, and law enforcement. The third front is our ongoing public policy advocacy. During the grant period, we have published 2 Veterans Justice-related law review articles in the Mitchell-Hamlin Law Review, and we produced a wide variety of other written materials, including a 90-page policy white paper, as well as shorter educational brochures, allowing people of all levels of interest, from legal practitioners to lay people, to engage and understand this topic. And finally, has been public education and outreach. To support the public understanding of these issues that bring veterans into the criminal justice system, to overcome the stigma that the public and veterans often attach to these issues, and to make veterans more aware of the resources available to them. This outreach has included an interactive website along with an accompanying Facebook page. Our Facebook page alone has reached over 42,000 people during the grant period. And we've also produced a series of videos. We have distributed those. I will not play the video in the interest of time, but I believe you'll have access to a 5-minute educational video to see an example of what we have produced. Our videos have reached over 6,000 people during the grant period, and we have several more in the pipeline. Our new grant request would simply allow us to continue and complete our Minnesota mission over the next 2 years. Though we've educated 1,000 criminal justice stakeholders across Minnesota, there are thousands more that have not yet been reached and not yet been trained. We anticipate not just providing education, but intensive day-long nuts and bolts training seminars, multidisciplinary training seminars to judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and other stakeholders. The bottom line is this 2 years will allow us to fully complete this process, and with hopefully the passage of the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, a full rollout to ensure that that statute is properly implemented and used to save the lives of veterans across the state. In summation, together we can do a better job this time around with this generation of veterans in the justice system than we did with the Vietnam generation. Together we can ensure that psychologically injured veterans are restored as assets and reintegrated into the communities that they once risked their lives to protect. Together, we can ensure no veteran is left behind in the criminal justice system.
Thank you. Any other testifiers, Representative Zhang? In the interest of time, Mr. Johnson, keep it brief, please.
Tommy Johnson, VFW Legislative Officer, VFW Homeless Officer. And I'll make this very quick because I can't speak nearly as eloquently as everybody else that has spoken has. But in our presentation, we talked about the VFW's support for the bill and for the appropriation. And I would like to point out that as much as discussion has been going on about the veteran, the difference it really makes is in the child and in the spouse. That some kid that my mommy is a hero instead of my mommy is locked up. My daddy is a hero instead of my daddy's locked up. And this is because the VFW, as with so many VSOs, consider the family as important as the veteran. So we are in total support of this, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Members, I apologize. I was wondering if the bill author had any more testifiers. I was going to call for the audience here in a minute. So the chair moves the A4 amendment. The amendment simply adds language that would require the Veterans Defense Project to provide an annual report to the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs and Legislature and the legislature. Any further discussions on this? Any questions or discussions on this amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A4 amendment is adopted. Representative Detmer, would you like to offer the A2 amendment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to, the key thing with the A2 amendment is I wanted to make sure that the money is actually going to support our veterans. And I know in the past we've provided funding before for, through the humanities. And the humanities, don't get me wrong, the Humanities Center is a great, great center that we have. They do so many other things besides working with veterans. And the MDVA's role is solely for veterans. So what my first part of my amendment does, it puts the money through the MDVA as so there's oversight by the MDVA. And the second thing the amendment does is basically what we've already passed in one of the other amendments is that there's an overview by the Veterans Defense Project budget, the detailed explanation of expenditures, the number of veterans and people in the military that are served, and detailed services provided. And also the details of the education outreach to the legal assistance programs. So that was my biggest concern, is that the money would go directly to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs that would have the oversight of what's going on with this program. Otherwise, it's a great program. Nothing against the Minnesota Humanities. I've worked with them on other projects. They have other things that they do with veterans also. The Veterans Award Program that they have a big banquet every year. But I think the department is probably the best route to go with this funding. Thank you. And I would like the support on this.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. And I have talked to MDVA on this, and they are indifferent to whether it goes through them or whether it goes through Humanities, either way. So any discussion on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay?
No.
No.
Motion is denied. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of this bill? Or against? All right. Representative Zhang renews his motion that House File 430 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, with the recommendation that it be sent to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Zhang and Mr. Hunter. I appreciate the tolerance, folks, on staying over a little bit longer. Next week we will be hearing the budget overview from the governor's budget. The meeting is adjourned.